So for our sit this evening, actually, I wanted to give you some themes to become curious about as we're sitting together. You probably noticed the title of my talk around language and how it can be both confining and, if used correctly, can actually be quite liberating. And I'm going to invite you to explore both of these poles around language. The first one, how confining language can be and what it's actually like to drop language. So, for example, in your sitting meditation, it can be simply making the shift of beginning with the feeling of your body sitting and having a sense of the body sitting. And then to drop that frame, and what is it like to actually sense that activity that we're calling the body sitting? And just begin to take in what a vast world that is, this thing that we're calling the body. And I'm sure you're going to notice it's something that's changing moment after moment after moment. Just the activity of feeling sitting, there's pulsation, there's vibration, there's all this movement that's happening. And it's so radically different than the sentence, the body is sitting, or I'm observing my body sitting. Or around the breath, just to notice the difference between when you have the sense of paying attention to the breath and noticing that the direct activity is so much vaster than the word breath. You really do it around anything. Noticing how the mind might frame an experience in the sense of, oh, there's a sound, oh, I'm really hot, and the experience is so much vaster than that. Like one comparison to this is, I think sometimes, for those of you who are involved in any kind of artistic endeavor, I think that's one of the powerful things about being involved in some kind of artistic endeavor, is it can bring us into a space that feels like it's beyond language. So what's it like to touch that while you're meditating tonight? And what do you notice about that? And also to notice the other dynamic that's going to happen, which I notice a lot, is how quickly description will come in. So here I am, I'm paying attention to the breath, and then I start to think, oh, maybe Brian's going to want us to say something after the sit. What should I say? And then there's the language coming in. And just to notice that, how description can be so quick, that comes after or even before this touching of direct experience. So that's kind of experiment number one. And it is true, I'd love to hear what you notice. And then the other thing that I invite you to become curious about as we're sitting is actually the opposite in some way. Is how language can be useful, how it can be useful in terms of a few things. One, it can bring the mind back. Oh, interesting. Oh, thinking was happening. And there's a coming back. Or what I find it really helpful for is clarifying experience, because I can be lost in experience, especially around emotion or thinking. I find if there's an emotion going on, once I get the word for it, it's like there's a kind of presence that I can begin to be with it. Like for a long time around anger or frustration, especially frustration, I'd be sitting and there'd be a feeling of frustration and I could label the sensations and there's thoughts. But once I come to the word frustration, there was like a turn, like, oh, this is what frustration's like. And then there was a kind of clarity. So I invite you to play with language to help to frame, to get a handle on, to bring some presence into the experience. So it could be language in terms of clarifying and what happens with that. We're going to compare both these experiments a little bit. And then number two, sometimes I'll use language to have a quality of acceptance. So I'm experiencing something that I don't want to experience. I love the phrase, oh, this too. This too is part of my meditation. Or if it's some mind state that I have a difficult time with, it could be I might label judging. And then the phrase, just like this. Oh, judging's just like this. Because my mind has a tendency to be like, oh, judging. Oh, my God. Not this again. Aren't I doing this practice to get rid of this? So again, and you might have your own phrase. I'm just offering those. But to see what it's like to use language skillfully and get a feeling of what's happening there. And then also the experience of going beyond language. What do you notice with that? What's that experience? As far as that goes. Sound good? Does this make sense? It's two realms? Okay, let's give it a try. Oh, also, I just want to check in. Does anyone need beginning instruction for Vipassana or refresher? Are we all set for that? We all set? Okay, good. So what I'll do is I'll lead us in a bit. So I invite us to begin by allowing your attention to come inward, either closing your eyes or looking down at the ground. And simply feeling the body sitting. And noticing how the direct experience is so much vaster than that sentence, feeling the body sitting. I now invite you to allow a quality of relaxation to be there. So you might want to relax the hands. The shoulders. Allowing for a quality of relaxation in the jaw, in the face. And then the eyes. Maybe relaxing the eyes, allowing them to rest back in their sockets. I now invite you to begin to contact the breath, feeling the breathing. Maybe begin with a general sense. And noticing that the direct experience of feeling the breathing is so much vaster than my words. Once again, welcome. It's actually always a delight to come back to Albuquerque. As I already mentioned, what I'd like to share with you tonight is some reflections on this frame I'm giving to a part of our practice, how language can be so confining in our lives. And part of the practice is moving beyond language as a way of relating to our experience in a different way. And yet, at the same time, language can also be quite liberating if we use it correctly. And so that's the kind of the reflections I'd like to share tonight and the exploration. And to begin with this, first piece that I gave you, you could say experiment number one, which was, what's it like to go beyond language? And probably you notice this, the sense of how simple sometimes it can be freeing just in a very brief way of just directly contacting the breath or the sense of the body that's beyond that word. And actually, I think the Zen poet Ryokan captures it well in this haiku. He says, "There's a bamboo grove in front of my hut. Every day I see it 1,000 times, yet never tire of it." So again, there is a bamboo grove in front of my hut. Every day I see it 1,000 times, yet never tire of it. Do you hear how in that simple haiku there that you have the sense how the bamboo grove is not the same bamboo grove moment after moment? And that's where I want to start, is that this is what the promise, you can say, of part of this practice is going beyond language because of the freshness of this moment when we can drop these concepts that can be so confining. And for me, it's an important topic because I think this is one of the big draws for me of this path and this practice is just this quality of going beyond language. When I first got interested in meditation and in Buddhism, it was in a time in my life where I was desperately seeking some kind of answer, really using language in some kind of way through studying, as if there would be some kind of answer to solve a lot of my problems out there. Boy, I tried so hard and it was so fruitless. And I think that was the powerful thing about this practice. And I don't even think I could really understood that this was the process that was going on as I finally found something that allowed me to touch this activity of living in a way that didn't need to be mediated by words or language, and that I could start to find a different way of being in the world and relating to the world that in some ways I couldn't even be in language, but was starting to emerge just through the meditation and the other aspects of this path. I think part of it is setting aside this desperation I had to try to find, quote unquote, the answer through language. And here I had this medium to touch something deeper. And maybe some of you have also experienced that with the practice of going beyond that, these places where we're desperately trying to find some notion or concept that will catch it. And of course, there's so many wonderful things about language, which we'll get to. But when I have this idea that I'm going to find the answer, for me, there's been so much suffering. And again, to have this opening to a different way of being instead. And it really can be quite amazing to begin to enter into that world. I think Walt Whitman puts it well. This is in his actually first notebook. You could hear just in this quote that I'll share with you how it precedes some of the ideas that come from his work, Leaves of Grass. He says, "Bring all the art and science of the world and baffle and humble it with one spear of grass." Again, bring all the art and science of the world and baffle and humble it with one spear of grass. Do you hear this pointing to the direct experience of just a blade of grass? And how vast that is, even compared to the sciences or the arts that we have. And how available that can be through this practice that we're doing. And I want to point out that's one of the aspects that we're training in, that it's a kind of a training and a practice that we're taking on when we do this practice. And what I want to do is take some time just to explain how language, on one level, it's so limiting because it's limiting in terms of how it limits how I connect and relate to others. And it limits how I connect and relate to myself. And I'm sure there's examples that you can think of. And I just want to give you one example to help flesh this out. About 10 years ago, I was staying with a friend in Boston in the Jamaica Plain neighborhood, which some of you might know. And we had gone out for the night to a poetry reading, a poetry slam called A Gender Crash, which is... It was fantastic. And what it was is it was really an open mic or a poetry group for the queer and transgendered communities in Boston. And for me, I think what was so liberating about it was beginning to see how quickly my mind... bifurcates the world in terms of gender, in terms of this binary thing. Like, so immediately there's a thinking of man, woman. And it was so wonderful to come against that in the sense of meeting people that don't fit into that binary category and really seeing that that's just a construction of the mind. That is something that my mind has been formed by, a kind of language that is created how my mind looks at the world. And to me, that's a perfect example of how language confines how I see the world. Just in these two simple constructs, and it really is a construct. And so much of our lives, sometimes if we're not around that, so much of our lives we can think that man and woman are not constructs, but they really are. And we can also see how confining that is. For some people, especially, to be confined in that way. And also in our own lives, sometimes have you ever felt the confining quality of what it is to be a man or what it is to be a woman in these messages that we're given? And have you noticed also we can be aware of those messages, but then you can see those messages working in your own life? So I want to point out, when I'm talking about this, you know, I started with you going beyond just the notion of breath or body, but how deep language permeates into our experience. Really, really quite subtle. And hopefully with this you can see how confining it is, how I can find myself and others often with language. And I also want to point out the what we're interested in when we're doing this practice is all I need to do is see that. Just to see, oh, this is a construction of the mind. This is a fabrication that is being placed upon experience. I don't need to get rid of it. Actually, in many ways, don't need to change it. I need to see that it's arising, and I need to see it for what it is. Because then that's going to be really freeing. My mind still might be bifurcating the world in terms of man and woman, but then I can see it. I can see that it's just a habitual tendency of this mind. And also, with this example, you might hear what's implied in this is that what we're doing on the cushion, when I'm practicing going beyond the breath or the body, it has ramifications, it has implications about how I am in the world. And it has this social context as well, which can be so important around issues about how we define each other. And you could say there's a Pali word that the Buddha uses around this process, Pali being the early scriptural language of Buddhism, the word being sankhara. And this word sankhara is translated in different ways, and actually it means something a little bit different in different contexts. In a general way, I think one way that it's translated is as fabrication, like a mental fabrication, or a concoction, so concoctions of the mind or fabrications of the mind. The monastic Ajahn Suchito gives the translation of habitual patterns, which I really appreciate, which is really what I'm talking about. This is, you could say, a deeper level of what I mean by language. And hopefully by now you can get a sense of how important it is to go beyond language if we're really interested in freedom. Not just to have the groovy experience of the bamboo grove moment after moment, but how we are in the world and how we relate to the world. And we do it to ourselves too, right? A lot of times, have you noticed the stories that we can carry around? I'm no good, something's wrong with me. I'm not very smart. It could be the opposite too. I'm so good. Nothing's wrong with me. I am so intelligent. Again, there's the framing. There can be an habitual tendency of how we hold ourselves. And so quick. Another, you could say, a modern term for this is implicit bias. How we have these biases that can come up just around when we see somebody, see a body shape, hearing someone's accent, if someone's tall or short, the clothes that they're wearing, it can be so quick. You know, in one test, this is something that happens in this country a lot, is they did a test around implicit bias in terms of people who appear to be elderly. and around people who appear to be elderly, 80% of the people who are taking this test had a negative bias towards those people. Is this something that they would outwardly say? Probably not. But again, it's an habitual pattern, so it's a habitual tendency that we're in some ways given about how we treat the elderly or how we relate to those who appear elderly. And we see it a lot of times in the way that strata of our population is treated. So language, it's so deep. Sankharas are so deep. These habitual patterns, these fabrications are so deep. And again, it's the same thing. I simply need to notice it happening with acceptance so that the mind isn't hooked by it. And it's true. There is a place for this. In some ways, I also want to normalize just, you know, how this arises. To remind you, you are a mammal. And what comes with that is one of the great things about that is if I'm in the woods and I see a bunny rabbit or a grizzly bear, I'm glad that there's a little bit of a fabrication about what's safe and what's not safe, where I'm not really thinking about it, so that there's a quick reaction to take care of the situation. It can be really helpful to have how this mind fabricates. It can keep us safe. So it's not like we want to get rid of it. But I also don't want to be hooked by it in a way that creates suffering for myself or others. So we're not here to demonize the mind. We're here to see it clearly. And it happens, again, so quickly. This happens just... Another example, just last week we had a family gathering and we were celebrating my wife's 50th birthday. And my brother-in-law was there. And I haven't had a lot of interaction with my brother-in-law, but the one thing I know about my brother-in-law is that he actually used to work for Dick Cheney. So there was some explicit bias around this, to say the least. But it was so interesting talking to him. So we were talking, he's gotten really interested in philosophy, and we're talking about philosophy, and he's very Catholic. And I started to talk about liberation theology, which has it was a movement in Catholicism that actually was quite strong in Central America, which had a lot of Marxist underpinnings to it. And so we started to talk about Karl Marx, and, you know, so I was asking him, so what do you think about, I asked him, what do you think about Marx's critique of capitalism? You know, I'm really curious about this because we were talking about the poor and things like that. And he said, oh, I so agree with that critique. And he said, you know, don't think just because I worked for under a Republican administration that I think like them. And it was so great to hear that, to see that, oh, I had a few words about his past. That's all I had. And I had this huge story about who he was. And it was based on my bias. And also what happens with that bias is it's as if I can't see the person in front of me. And I can't have a real open conversation because I'm already assuming what they think or who they are. We're so much more vast than language. We're so much vast than what we can put into words. And I want to point out, at the deepest level, you could say, really what this is about is this teaching that you find in Buddhism, especially later Buddhism, on emptiness. Emptiness not as a noun, but as an adjective. So what I mean by that is emptiness referring to that each moment we can't find any, like, fixed thingness to experience. There's nothing inherent in experience that is solid and fixed. It's always changing. So I can't use the word body because it's already changed into another body the next moment. In its essence, that's the world that we live in. And the more I understand it, the more I can partake in this fluid unfolding of experience that can be really quite freeing for myself and the world that we're living in. So you might hear all the different levels of really what it is to go beyond language and how important it is to what we're doing. So let's go on. Language, it's a pretty good thing, though. How does that lead to our suffering, our figure out how it leads to our suffering. How does it lead to our freedom? And again, if there's any anything you want to share about if you used any labels or words or language while you were sitting. And Beverly, thank you very much for saying that. Just the using of this too, there was a shift, a different relationship. Thank you for that. And what I appreciate is this phrase you used, that it's in some ways a practice of replacing the conditioning that's there to kind of give this, that's what's going on. This turn, using language to kind of undermine habitual tendencies. Yeah, and some great examples of that. Yeah, so thank you. Yeah, I think that's one way we are using labeling. We're still undermining these habitual tendencies, but we're using language to, in some ways, undermine language or how we see. Yeah. Actually, I want to share with you again some poetry by Ryokan, which I think demonstrates this a little bit. Actually, I find poetry so powerful in this realm because it has this tendency a lot of times to undermine how I see things. And that's what I find is really powerful poetry. Actually, there was a writer, Argentinian writer, by the name of Jorge Luis Borges. And I appreciate how he defines poetry or the poet's task. He says, "Things are as they are, but they are hidden. And my task as a poet is to find them." So things are as they are. And really, that's what we're trying to do with this practice, is seeing that things are just as they are, but they're hidden. And that one makes it so difficult, is that I can't see it so clearly. It feels like it's hidden. And then here's this task of the poet, is to actually find them, to reveal them. I think here's one example of this by the poet Ryokan. Just a little background. So Ryokan was most of his life he was a hermit. He was a Zen monk who was a hermit, and really eccentric in a beautiful way. He'd go down into the village and when he would beg for food, and then he'd usually spend most of the day just playing with kids. He loved to play games, and then he'd go up and practice. So a really great combination. And he says, "Don't say my hut has nothing to offer. Come, and I will share with you the cool breeze that fills my window." So again, "Don't say my hut has nothing to offer. Come, and I will share with you the cool breeze that fills my window." What I so appreciate about that short poem is how it turns for me the idea of what I possess and what I have to offer others. What is he offering? The cool breeze at his window. What a powerful thing. Do you hear how just with that poem, it can give a whole different sense of what it means to be generous and even what it means to have? And how we can have such a narrow view of what it is to be generous, or such a narrow view of a sense of what we actually really have or truly have. What a beautiful thing to offer, the cool breeze at your window. And again, along these same lines, just these two lines of Ryokan, the short haiku. "The thief left it behind, the moon at my window." The thief left it behind, the moon at my window. Again, do you have that sense of the kind of fullness that's in his life? Recognizing, here's this, the most amazing thing in his experience is this vast moon at his window, something that no one can take away. Again, do you hear how that can disrupt, how confining it is about the round our things and what we can quote-unquote lose and what we actually have? Again, words that can take us beyond language. So So then language in terms of when we're sitting in meditation, kind of what I was inviting you to do, to use language as we're meditating. And again, I think it can do the same thing. It can really help clarify or disrupt some of the habitual tendencies that I have. As I was saying at the beginning, that was a powerful turn for me when I could start to label frustration. And the reason for that is because it was something that was driving my behavior that I wasn't aware of. And by naming it, all of a sudden, it might not have gone away, but it didn't drive me as much. There was a clarity that, oh, this is actually what's going on. I don't have to be lost in this. And then there's this space. There's a space around that that allows for a different way of being in the world. And I find labeling so helpful for that because it clarifies. I'm labeling pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, which is so great because then I can see the reactivity that arises out of that. I'm labeling emotion. I'm labeling thought patterns. Oh, this is just judging. Oh, interesting. Yeah. Oh, judging is just like this. It's just another state of mind. Do you hear how when I use the label judging, how powerful that is? Because there's a turn. It's not I am judging or I'm such a horrible person for judging or this needs to stop. It's just a phenomenon that's arising and passing away. And that can be captured with that label judging. I can undermine the sense of meanness or a sense that there's something wrong. And it can also bring out subtlety. Sometimes when I label sensation, sometimes it can open up a new facet of experience. Just when I'm paying attention to the breath, sometimes if I feel a subtle tightness that I might not have noticed, oh, interesting. Using the word tightness helps clarify that's what's going on. Or I notice there's a sense of pleasant calmness there, something that is so easy to not see. And when I see it, there can be a sense of resting in that. And you can notice just with just using words, one word can give so much of a different nuance than another word around the, you could say, the quote-unquote same experience. For example, if I were to take an object like a rock, or I could call it a stone. And you hear just on that level how it can bring out a different nuance just about that one object. A rock. Sometimes when I hear the word rock, it's like what I see in my mind's eye are the edges of it, the sharpness of it from the k. And then the stone, sometimes it has the smoothness of it. So sometimes a word can convey a kind of feeling tone that can allow me to have a handle on it and to feel into it. So I'm not just skipping on the surface of experience, but I'm digging deep into it to get a feeling sense. And you can hear probably just with those two words that as a poet in poetry, when there's a sensitivity to using words like that, it can open up experience in that way. And then I want to talk a little bit about a broader use of language, too, that sometimes we don't talk a lot about in Vipassana, which is so important, which is just the practice of reflection. But sometimes for me to move through, to have a different relationship with experience, what's really helpful is to reflect, to actually talk to myself. It can be very, very helpful because it helps shift how I'm relating to things. So one example of this happened last week. I was coming back from the Bay Area, California, and I was on a flight that was going to arrive into Phoenix at 8:59 p.m. It's a flight that I've taken often. And at 9 p.m., there's a shuttle that goes up to Flagstaff. And the next shuttle is at 10:30 p.m. So I've done this actually a number of times where if the flight's on time and I run, I can catch the shuttle. And which is great because then I get I don't have to get home as late. I can have a nice full night of sleep. This last time, there was a little bit of a difference, which I was so appreciative of. So here I am on the plane, and then usually what starts to happen is I have these thoughts, and I can have this feeling of like, come on, can we just get to the gate? And it's almost like this impulse, like, I know it sounds crazy, like I'm trying to push the plane into the gate to get everything else, to push the gas just a little. Can you just go a little bit faster on the runway just to get there? And there's this sense, and I'm looking at my watch. I'm trying to see if we're going to get there on time. And there's this whole world that starts to happen as if I'm trying to make something happen that's actually completely out of my control. And luckily this time, it was the sense of when that started to happen, it was this reflection of, what do I really want? Do I want to do this, or do I want contentment? What's really valuable? Like, is all this stress worth getting home an hour and a half early? Is it really? And that was a really important reflection before I started to meditate or to sense into it, because I could be sensing into it as a way of struggling through it. But what needed to happen first was, this is what's important to me is peace and to actually be here for my life rather than to try to make something happen that I don't have control over anyway. And there was such an opening around that just from that reflection. And then from the reflection, then I can be with whatever's arising. But what was there is a commitment to my contentment. And I've realized sometimes when I'm meditating, there's not a commitment to that. I'm just trying to struggle through the experience. Still hoping I'm going to make the shuttle. Because I'm not catching that underlying, almost the wanting that's underneath it. Again, such a skillful use of language so I can break through something that I get so easily lost in. And then just a poem that I feel like it goes on an even deeper level of how, again, language can express these deeper states of really going beyond language in these really quite subtle and profound ways. This is a short poem by the Chinese poet Li Po, or Li Bai. He was from the Tang Dynasty, 8th century, and some people consider him one of the greatest Chinese poets. He says, "The birds have vanished in the sky, and now the last cloud drains away. We sit together, the mountain and I, until only the mountain remains." The birds have vanished in the sky, and now the last cloud drains away. We sit together, the mountain and I, until only the mountain remains. Do you hear in this short poem this expression of going beyond one of the fundamental qualities of language, namely language, particularly in English, having a subject and a verb, that there has to be me looking at the mountain, and yet using language to really convey that there can be a different experience than me looking onto the world? And how we can hear that with the disappearance where only the mountain remains. Yeah, so may our use of language and going beyond language really lead to our own freedom and the freedom of all beings. Thank you.